Welcome to the Leadership Journey podcast. My name is Alan Wilson. I am the host of the podcast, and each week we try to give you the opportunity to reflect on some of the things that make up a leadership journey. This week, my guest is Jonathan Ray. Jonathan is the creative director of New Irish Arts. Jonathan, welcome to the Leadership Journey podcast. It's good to have you on this.
Thank you.
And just to clarify, in case anybody's sort of tuned in and think you're the motorbike rider, no, you're not.
No, definitely not.
I think a lot of us were very disappointed at the waterfront at Christmas time that you didn't appear on a motorbike. It would have been a great grand entrance.
Yes, it would have, but yeah. Didn't seem the right way to go.
Okay, Jonathan, you are the creative director of New Irish Arts. Tell us a little bit about that organisation and what does it mean to be the creative director? It sounds like a wonderful title, actually.
It's a lovely job title, but that's a nice job, actually. New Irish Arts is a Christian charity, and we're known most for the New Irish Choir and Orchestra, which is a Christian choir and orchestra that does sort of in different guises and shapes and sizes about 20 to 25 events per year. Essentially, what the organisation is trying to do is trying to be a Christian presence within the arts and also an artistic presence within the church. And there's a commitment there to providing music for all sorts of different types of events. But I guess there's also a vision to try and share Christianity and be a resource to the wider church and work alongside other people, both in the facilitating of events and also in training and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's quite a broad remit that the organisation has, and although we're called New Irish Arts, most of our work is centred around music. We occasionally collaborate with other disciplines, you know, writers and poets and whatnot, visual artists, and so that's what New Irish Arts does. And
okay.
It's my privilege as creative director to lead that organisation and give it creative direction over the course of I've been there, I guess, since in different shapes and sizes of role since the early 2000s.
And the organisation has been running, what, just over 20 years? 22?
That's over 20 years. 22 now, yes.
Oh, okay. And I think people who are familiar with New Irish Arts, I mean, I think
it's
a lot
24,
of...
It's 24, actually.
It's 24?
Yeah, it is.
Wow,
yeah.
So next year's the 25th.
Yes.
Right, big plans?
I haven't thought about that yet.
You know, obviously some of the people listening will be familiar with, you know, for example, the Christmas concerts at the waterfront and that kind of thing, and they'll know you from your role at the front where you're directing the orchestra and the choir, you're comparing as well. What does some of the rest of the work look like then? You know, what does a week look like for you when you're not actually on stage?
Okay, well, this week.
Yeah, this week apart from sitting here.
This week there's been a number of different things going on. We have a little event on Saturday in Cavan where we're taking about 10 singers and about the same number of players to do a concert which is being organised by a church but put on in a local hotel. And to try and reach members of the community there in a way that perhaps it wouldn't be if it was within their own church building.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks' time, we're doing something on a larger scale in Belfast Cathedral, which is a St. Patrick's Night celebration, which has been hosted in the cathedral by Newton Breda Baptist Church,
okay.
Who again are trying to do an outreach event, and they're using the cathedral essentially as a big, well-known place in the centre of the city where they feel people will want to come.
Yeah, is that, as a matter of interest, is that something that's open, you know, is that open to the public? Can people go online and book tickets for that? Because it's, you know, as I know we were recording this a little earlier, but
yeah,
it's still, you know, when the podcast goes out, it'll still be in the future.
Yes, 17th of March is,
okay,
is the night, obviously. It's a nice celebration,
yeah.
Seems the night to do it.
Yeah.
So that those are the two things that are going at the moment. We have a significantly sized youth wing now that has sort of formed within the last few years. We've got a choir that does a residential in the summer, and in April we're doing our very first orchestra residential for young players. And I guess a lot of what we're doing with that is trying to invest in the future to get healthy attitudes to the arts, music and service,
mm-hmm.
into young people at an early stage, and to try and encourage the people to use their gifts in a way that's going to honour God.
Yeah.
So the choir I guess functions a little bit like a scripture union camp or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, where you come along and you're there for the 6 days. And we do choir rehearsals and lots of other fun activities, and the orchestra we're now trying to do on a similar vein, and
yeah,
at the end of it we put on a concert for the parents to come along and enjoy,
yeah,
it. But really it's the investment of the time into those young people that's the key thing with it.
Right.
And providing the whole idea is to try and provide something that's different from what they do when they are in their school orchestras and their county orchestras and whatnot.
And what's the essential difference? What would you say?
I think the essential difference is that it's all within a Christian context.
Right. Okay.
And so what you're performing Christian music and trying to do it to a high standard.
Yeah.
And we have the opportunity to teach the Bible as well, and we'll probably do some teaching which is around the whole issues of how you serve in a church with the gift that you've been given.
Okay.
And use that in a sort of helpful and intelligent and supportive way for what is going on. Okay.
I mean, it raises questions. I think that we'll pick it up a little later in the podcast. Just in, you know, the whole thing about Christians and the arts, because I think, you know, particularly in certain Christian circles, probably people haven't really known what to do with the arts. You know, music, yeah, a bit, but some of the others, the other disciplines of the arts, well, not really at all.
Yes, I think historically there's even been some suspicion of the arts within the conservative Christian church, particularly. I'm from the conservative Christian church, and so I understand that viewpoint. I guess in terms of trying to keep the main gospel priorities that a lot of churches have, there's been a suspicion of anything that's kind of fuzzy around the edges.
Yeah. Fuzzy around the edges, yeah.
And I think there's actually something that's been missed there along the way for a long time. And I see the organisation that I'm in as a place where connections can be made and bridges can be built that normal mainstream ministry doesn't always manage to do.
Yeah.
I think also there's the whole idea, you know, that beauty is something which is which comes from God.
Mm-hmm.
Even back as far as Jonathan Edwards and the Enlightenment, the whole uniqueness of God being found in his beauty and his glory.
Yeah.
And I think the whole idea of doing things that are beautiful and attractive in the name of God is an honourable thing to do.
Yeah.
And I would never want our ministry to be the whole voice of the church, but it's one little corner that sits alongside it in a meaningful way, trying to support the bigger, wider ministry of the church and of God's kingdom.
Yeah, let's come back to that maybe a little later. I'm sure there's a lot more that you'd want to say in relation to that. But talk to us a little bit about how you've got to the place where you are today. And I'm thinking there's going to be a couple of tracks here. One is your own development as an artist, but also your development as a Christian. And I suppose, obviously, those tracks they're not parallel. Well, they're parallel in one sense, but there's another sense in which they're very much...
They keep converging along the way.
Converging parallel tracks. Talk to us a little bit about your journey then.
Yeah, my parents were Christians. My father worked, first of all, for the Belfast City Mission and was then a minister in congregational churches as I was growing up. And so I grew up in a pastor's house, and my parents put a huge amount of time and energy into making sure I knew the gospel and was... we went to everything that it was possible to go to in church and in other places as well. You know, Christian heritage is very much part of my upbringing, and I'm thankful to God for that.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask you, growing up as a pastor's kid, I'm assuming that your musical ability developed when you were quite young. Was evident. Did you get pressed into playing in church and all this kind of thing?
Pressed is the wrong word. I loved it from the get-go. Right. I guess our family sang together and things like that around the mission halls and churches in the land. And it was funny because, I always joke that at the time you think, you know, people come along and tell you it sounds great and all the rest of it. Then I realised after a long time that actually weren't really all that good.
Do you ever go back and listen to any of the recordings? Do you have
they exist? Yeah. No, I don't. Some things are best forgotten. We did a lot of that sort of thing, and that was good because it connected for me very quickly the idea of my faith and the music, and that the music was for serving with.
Yeah,
I think the development of my Christian faith. I mean, I became a Christian at a very young age. Mm-hmm. I suppose I was probably about 17 when I claimed my faith as my own, personally.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened because I knew I was going away a year down the line, almost certainly to study.
Yeah.
Which then happened. I was privileged to go to Cambridge and had 4 happy years there studying music.
Mm-hmm.
And then did a PGCE as well. And I guess my Christian identity began to take shape a little bit more there in my own right as an adult. Mm-hmm. Because you sort of realise then when you go home that you have to make your own decision about whether you attend church or read the Bible or do anything, in fact. So that for me that breaking away from the home was almost where my faith began to be defined, mm-hmm. as a thing that was mine.
Yeah, yeah.
And
did it look very different from the faith that you'd grown up with? Or was it just a deeper, more mature form of what you'd grown up with?
I don't know that it was deeper mature at the time. I was a student. I think probably it looked different in the sense that it was mine and I was finding my own vocabulary.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's funny. The first act of rebellion I ever did, really, in the parental home, was to buy a different version of the Bible. My father was very much a King James Version uh-huh. man. Uh-huh. And so I bought myself an NIV when I was 17 and began to read the Bible. I don't want to over-dramatise this, but there was a sense in which I found beauty in the whole idea of the Bible being in our own language.
Yeah.
That freed me up to understand it myself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that I didn't understand the KJV, because I've been immersed in it since sure. I was sure. tiny.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something about the fluency of text being in a more normal language of speech.
Yeah, there wasn't a little sort of was it an artistic distance, if I could put it like that? You had to navigate.
No. So I began to enjoy that. I guess I became involved in leading Christian Union in Cambridge, and that was a very formative period. And I remember...
Why?
It was formative because I suddenly had Christian responsibility for an organisation that was trying to reach the university with the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very challenging. I thrived on the business of working with a big volunteer group of people who were trying to do one thing together. And I guess I can see now that there was something, there was a template being laid something that would come later. I guess I found myself in Cambridge because of the music.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll go back now mm-hmm. and then talk about the convergence.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back to the musical development, from a very early age, I was able to play tunes on the piano. Mm-hmm. If I heard them, I knew how to play them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always regarded that as something that God has given me, just as a skill set that's there. Neither of my parents could do that. Nobody in my family had any real interest in music.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would have thought of sending me to lessons had I not been able to play already.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were various people along the way who shaped my musical development. And it started right from the lady who played the organ in the little mission hall where mm-hmm. we were, who would let me come up before the service and hammer out little tunes on the old Hammond organ. And then we moved to Newton Ards. There was a man there who was a more qualified musician, I guess, who was a real gentleman to me, actually. And when I was 9, he went and bought an old piano and refurbished it in his own garage and put it into the church so that there could be piano and organ together at the mm-hmm. one time, so that he could... And it was his way of... And I thought it was him allowing me to serve and to do what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it was his way of investing in me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I see that now as an adult, that it was a really powerful thing he did, and he put the labour of his own hands into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very touched by that. I remember him coming to the house one night to put me over a song we were going to be doing in church, and teaching me some new chords, I think, on the piano. And feeling this, you know, that was really interesting, because it opened up a whole new musical vocabulary mm-hmm. to me. So he was very important. There was a man called Raymond Finlay, still alive. And still serving in the same church as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then through my
Does he come to some of the events that you do?
Very occasionally, yes. Right, he does. Okay. He's quite elderly now, but yes, he does.
Well, that must be rich for him to see the way his investment is paid off.
I think so. He's a very humble man.
Yeah.
He's a very spiritual man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he would never say that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
you can say it.
Yes. Through secondary education, there was a teacher I had in school. In fact, a couple of teachers who were very formative. A languages teacher, actually, who mm-hmm. invested a lot of time in me in terms of my understanding of how to express myself. And
this is in Regent House, is it?
In Regent House in Newton Ards, yes. Mm-hmm. And
Was that John?
John Long, Tom, yes, yes. Yeah. John had been the son of a minister as well.
Yeah.
And I guess he helped me to train my brain a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time as that, there was a Christian music teacher who'd been in the school, and whose time in the school actually exactly overlapped mine, a man called Keith Rogers,
mm-hmm.
Who was a very talented, quite eccentric music teacher, mm-hmm. Who was interested in lots and lots of quite unusual niche things in early music and things like that. But he helped me to develop my faith in my music in parallel. And I guess fostered ideas about excellence and doing mm-hmm. things well and so on, and helping with my piano technique and mm-hmm. that sort of thing as well. And just really got alongside me and invested a lot mm-hmm. Over the course of those years.
Were there people who helped to, you know, sort of bridging these two things? You know, obviously, you know, there's a sense in which playing music in church bridges music and faith.
Yes.
But were there people who then began to give you a vision for how the connection between music and faith could go far beyond that?
I think that began to happen later. What actually happened was that as a student, I remember going to my director of studies and having a conversation, which I've regretted for years since. Mm-hmm. And it happened shortly after I was asked to leave the CU in Cambridge. And I went to him, and it was taking a lot of time, you mm-hmm. can imagine. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I was saying, you know, really, I'm not sure that my future lies in music at this point. Mm-hmm. And maybe I have a sense of calling to some sort of ministry, I don't know. And it was frustrating for him because he had admitted me to the college to do a music degree. Mm-hmm. And I was effectively telling him, look, I'm not going to work as hard as you thought I was going to work mm-hmm. because this other thing's a big draw on me. And he was frustrated and a little upset at the time that I took that post on. And I always regretted not framing the conversation better
yeah.
and not holding the thing better in tension yeah. and actually also not redoubling my efforts to make sure that the reason I'd been given the place in the first place was the reason why I was, you know, investing my time. Mm-hmm. But at the time, the draw to serve the Lord in the context of the university felt like the bigger thing. Mm-hmm. But actually, I probably did a disservice in my relationship with him mm-hmm. because he saw deterioration he saw probably that my potential academically wasn't yeah. reached the way he had hoped it would be.
Do you think in any way that's reflective of, you know, for many of us that's reflective of, you know, a view that serving the Lord has to do with things like evangelism or teaching the Bible, and we're not sure what it means to serve the Lord with those wider things, wider gifts?
Yeah, I think this comes into play particularly when people talk about worship. And the whole idea of worship as the music that's in the church, or the thing, yeah. or even just exclusively the things that we do when we meet together to think about God.
Yeah.
So prayer is worship, listening to the sermon is an act of worship, all those things. But actually, how we approach Monday is as important as how we approach yeah. Sunday. And I guess I hadn't got that clear in my head yet. Yeah. That's it. So it was kind of like, oh, the music is kind of like the idol.
Yeah.
And the CU is the place where I can yeah. serve. Well, in actual fact, there was probably more investment to be done in both places. Yeah. And the two could have woven in together. And I guess the blurriness of the sacred and the secular is something that I've learned to embrace a lot more uh-huh. in adult life than yeah. I was at that stage in the black and white days of the student world.
Yeah. Did you ever feel... drawn in any way to follow in your father's footsteps and go into, you know, specific local church ministry?
At that stage, yes, mm-hmm. I did, because it felt like a natural following on from leading the CU mm-hmm. to lead a church. Mm-hmm. And I quickly realised, I was given advice at the time, actually by my father, who said that I shouldn't pursue that path unless I felt I had absolutely no alternative. Mm-hmm. I've since heard others frame that differently. Yeah. You know, if you feel yeah. you have the gifting for it, then you ought to do it.
Yeah.
And I don't know which of those is right, but in my story, what happened was that I took that advice very seriously mm-hmm. And moved towards a teaching career, actually. Did a PGCE and went and taught for 15 years in Bangor Grammar School, mm-hmm. which I had a great time there. Mm-hmm. And really enjoyed the interaction with the boys and the whole scene of being part of a community mm-hmm. that was very vibrant. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how that fitted ministry-wise, it was more a case of just trying to live as a normal, sensible Christian in the context of a secular role.
Yeah.
And I think it was important that I did that. I think that was an important part of my journey, because I began to realise that it wasn't just when you were doing things that were explicitly, exclusively Christian
yeah.
that you were doing something that carried any meaning.
Yeah. You say you began to realise, was that something you worked out for yourself, or were there people who were modelling this or teaching you or influencing you to think differently?
I had a conversation with Mark Dever when I started in the CU job. Mm-hmm. He was the assistant pastor in the church I was attending at the time.
So now Pastor Capitol Hill Baptist in Washington.
Yes, yeah. yes. Mm-hmm. And Mark said to me, I have one piece of advice for you. Don't let your identity be determined by the fact that you're the president of the CU. And I said, okay. And thought, what does he mean?
Yeah.
And so I got to unpack it a little bit more. And he talked about deriving a spiritual identity that was between me and God. And I think that was kind of the start of that whole idea that it's, you know, that you are a child of God first.
Yeah.
And how you live your life around that has to be holistic. It has to make sense. And it took a while. I think probably my first engagement with my first interaction with New Irish Arts happened in and around the point when I graduated.
Yeah.
It was founded by Keith Getty, who's also been a huge influence over the years in lots of ways, and we've become very close friends.
Yeah.
As his work became more global, mine became more focused on New Irish, plugging the gap that he was leaving, and because he had started the organisation.
Because when he left Northern Ireland, in the 2000s, the mantle passed to you, really,
yes,
didn't it?
Yeah. But by that stage, he and I had had many long and late conversations, which shaped both of us, I think.
Yeah.
And there's a very strong peer relationship there. And I think that was the start, actually, of a support network for me of people who influence you who aren't people that you... I don't mean I don't look up to him, but what I mean is, you know, there's the
they're not 20 years ahead.
They're not 20 years ahead of you. So you come from the point where you're a kid growing up, and you look at the pastors and the leaders and so on, and then suddenly you start to emerge as an adult, and you work alongside others who are on the same path as you, and those relationships turn out to be very helpful long term, as people go through the various peaks and troughs of their life together, and I guess the friendship with Keith is just one of those types of influences that has formed over those years. So in terms of the convergence of music and my faith, suddenly there was this organisation that was on my doorstep that existed to present Christianity through the very thing that I understood how to use. I want to go back to one other person actually at this point and talk about a youth fellowship talk in the little congregational church we attended when I was about 13. And there was a guy there who was a music teacher called Sam Moreland, who had been a phenomenal classical guitar player, but was an elder in a little Pentecostal church in the city centre of Belfast. And he came to talk one night, and I was especially interested in him coming because he was this classical musician, and he worked as a music teacher and was good to young people and whatnot. And he talked that night about the passage in Exodus where Moses is spoken to God. God speaks to Moses through the burning bush. And Moses is expressing his doubts and so on. And God says to him, "What's that you have in your hand?" It's a staff. And he applied the talk quite simply that whatever you had in your hand, the thing that was naturally yours was the thing you should use for God. And in the same way as the staff became the symbol of God's authority in the presence of Pharaoh, then the power of the thing that you were made to do would be a way of you living out your Christian life meaningfully. And for me, it was so obvious because he was playing music that night that the application was the same for me. It was music. And so that was a very formative conversation. And I guess moving that forward to a place, a space in New Irish Arts where that actually could find legs. Was a very powerful thing, and I felt a very strong emotional draw to New Irish the first time I engaged with it. I remember standing the first concert I did, I was in the back of the choir. Sam was actually playing piano, as it happens. And I stand in the back of the choir and just thought, this is a wonderful thing. I can see real power in this. And we had really no idea what the direction of the organisation was going to be then. But we knew we were on the verge of something that was worth doing.
So basically, how it started up as a group of Christian people who loved music,
a bunch of Christians
who were
prepared to put something on to try and be a Christian presence in the arts.
Yeah.
So the vision is still the same, but I guess we've had 20 years now to think about how we actually work that out and what we really do.
Yeah. So you got involved in that, and obviously the first number of years in that, what you were a member of the choir.
That's right.
How did it happen then that you got asked to take on the role when Keith moved abroad?
It's a little bit of a blur, that one.
It's a blur.
but I think the answer is that Keith and I became very close friends.
Yeah.
And we went from friends who just occasionally met and chatted to friends who would talk about events and shaping concerts and shaping direction and writing songs and all sorts of different things together. And as we journeyed together on the natural path of friendship, he turned to me to do the bits that he didn't have time to do because his work was already taking him internationally at that stage. And I guess because I was coming with a little bit of background from the Cambridge choral system, because I was fortunate enough to be involved in various choirs in Cambridge, so I understood how to direct a choir. And I was happy enough working with orchestras as well. And as a piano player, you tend to have more of an overview of what's going on because you're playing one and one at a time. So you understand the big picture of the music more than what you would be if you were a trumpeter or something like that, where you want a single line melody. Because I, at that stage, was playing piano fairly regularly in the group and directing the odd choir rehearsal, you know, one thing led to another, and then suddenly I started to learn to arrange music for the group. And I guess the main thing was that we developed an understanding between us about how to shape events and became sounding boards off each other in lots of different aspects of things that were both musical and personal. And he learned to trust me then. And then it was a sort of organic growth into the role.
Because I imagine, you know, for him to found the organisation, and obviously since once he left Northern Ireland, he was going to have to hand it over to someone. But it's a big deal to hand over something that you have founded and grown it, and you know, let someone else run with it. Then
I'm helped by the fact that I know I'm not a founder of anything. My leadership journey has often involved taking things that are already someone else's idea and tweaking them or making them real. I'm more of a finisher than a starter. And so I enjoy taking things forward and giving them longer lasting legs. Whereas the entrepreneur guys, as Keith is, tend to have 25 ideas in one day about how to make something new happen. And I find those guys very stimulating, but I couldn't live in that headspace because I'm much more linear in terms of how I go about things.
Okay, Jonathan, we are at the end of our time, basically. So we've still got lots more to talk about. So we'll come back next time and we'll talk a little bit further. And thank you for taking the time to listen to the Leadership Journey podcast. Next week, Jonathan will be back. We'll talk some more. We'll pick up the second part of this story. Meantime, if you want to find out more about his work with New Irish Arts, you can go to newirisharts.com. And remember, yourleadershipjourney.net is the place where you can contact me in relation to the podcast. And you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. So thanks for listening. Have a good week and we'll talk to you next week.